I didn't leave Java. Java left me.
Before we jump into today's conversation, I've got a recommendation. Jonathan Hall, a friend of mine who was on the show 10 or so episodes back, well, he's got his own podcast that you should definitely check out. It's called Cup O' Go, and we do talk a lot about Go development here on this podcast, but we also talk about a lot of other stuff. And Cup O' Go is a great podcast if you really just want to keep going deeper on the Go programming language. So Cup O' Go, go check them out. They're on all the major podcasting platforms and on YouTube. Welcome to Backend Banter, the show about backend technologies and careers. Today, I am joined by John Bodner, the author of Learning Go. Super excited to have him on. John, do you want to take just a second and just a quick introduction? Who are you?
Sure. Name is John Bodner. Been a software engineer for over 25 years now. Hard to believe. Currently a staff engineer at Datadog. I work on making it easier for people to start using our products. I've worked in probably every corner of software at this point. Last several years, been focusing my career on Go. I'm excited about the language, and I was lucky enough to be able to write a book on it for O'Reilly. Came out in 2021. Second edition is now due out January 2024.
Hey, fantastic. O'Reilly has published so many programming books. It's really cool. How did you get in with O'Reilly? Just out of curiosity, just go like, hey, I want to write a book on Go. I'm going to go talk to O'Reilly.
I tried that. It didn't work. So it turns out, it, like everything else in life, it's kind of knowing people. So when I worked at Capital One, my job as a distinguished engineer was also giving conference talks. It was helping raise Capital One's reputation as a tech company. And I met Carmen Ando, who was on the Google team, working on the Go team at Google, at a conference. Met her again at another conference and mentioned her in passing, hey, I'd love to write a book on Go. And then at GopherCon that same year, she saw me in the hallway and said, the O'Reilly editor is down the hall. Go talk to her. I told you the best person to write this book. And so I met her and I met Zan and we went to a baseball game that night and that kind of sealed the deal. I sent a proposal in and wrote a book.
That's amazing. That's really cool. I didn't realize, I know nothing about the process. I've never written a book. Seems like a big undertaking. How long did it take, like start to finish?
Let's see. I guess I started it around September 2019. Yeah.
Okay.
The book was finished probably about a little bit more than a year later. Published in March of 2021.
Yeah. Okay. A year, a little over a year. I mean, it's a big book. It's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah. It was my pandemic project. It turned out some people baked bread. I explained pointers.
I love that. So what is it that got you interested in Go in the first place? You mentioned you've been coding for 25 years, but like Go hasn't been around that long.
No. So most of my career has actually spent on Java for the first half. So I first learned Java when I was in grad school, like Java 1.0 had come out. I had a research project that was actually hacking the JVM. I was really into Java for a long time. But the language was going places I didn't particularly like, just like the style of programming was much more around this annotation-driven style that was much more indirect. So you didn't quite know what was going on in your code. Like Java was the first time like OO made sense to me. So like it was very logical, procedural way of simplified language. Language was getting more complex. Techniques were getting more dynamic in a way. Harder to understand exactly what your code was doing. And then I saw the first Go demo, like when they first announced it in, I guess it was 2010.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And I saw the demo where they said we can compile the whole thing in like 5 minutes. I was like, this is pretty cool. And the names from it, you know, I grew up around Unix and like, oh, these are the Unix people who are doing this. There's probably something here. And the style for development was back to this very simple, basic, again, Unix kind of inspired style of build something small and practical that does something well and get rid of a lot of the fluff. And it's like, I didn't leave Java, Java left me. And so Go to kind of fit how I think about how you program and just found it an attractive way to do things.
That's really interesting to hear. When you say indirect, you said, you know, the way you felt you were writing Java over the years, or maybe the way that you were expected to write Java over the years felt more and more indirect. What could you give some examples of what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think a lot of this is really driven by Spring and its annotation-driven style of programming, where you have dependencies that are not explicit, they're implicit. So you just declare, you auto-wire a bunch of stuff, you do class path scanning and load your code in. I actually hit problems at work sometimes where you have this class that was declared to be auto-wired with a certain class to implement this interface, and you just sort of knew there's only going to be one implementation that's available. Well, it turned out we happened to write a second library that was pulled in, which implemented the same interface, and everything now blows up. And everything compiles, everything builds, everything deploys, and you try to run it, and it dies. Why? Because somewhere else, someone added a second implementation that's on your class path now. And the only way you discover this is by running it.
That's really interesting. That's like, I'm having a hard time wrapping my brain around, why would like third-party code implementing your interface blow anything up?
It was both first part, just different teams building the same thing, and someone else built this other implementation of the same interface, but this class was declared to look for one, and there's no discriminator put on saying, oh, this is the one I really meant. Which, you're doing that, just put the dependency in there directly, right? Why have this layer of indirection? When I was at Capital One, there's a framework called Chassis that's used internally to build Java applications, and Chassis was used for everything. It lowered the bar of difficulty, but when something went wrong with it, no one could actually tell you sometimes what was actually going wrong, because there are all these layers and layers of things calling things that you couldn't figure out. And I mean, people are very successful using Java. It's still one of the most popular languages in the world. Right. I can't say it doesn't work, because clearly it works, but my mental model doesn't fit with it well.
Got it. So you were early into Go then?
Pretty early. I mean, I wasn't getting paid to do it until probably like 2015, 2016. 2016, I guess.
Wow, but you heard about it. I mean, back in 2010, that's like, or 2011, yeah. That's super early. So what were you doing? Just like building side projects, fun stuff?
Yeah, I was learning and just writing little tools. I wrote a version of Lisp that's up in my GitHub repo just to like learn how to build it. It was just to like see what Go is like, and so over to Lisp. it's very small, though you can't use it for anything. But it's just like, what's the smallest thing you can do as a project to like get a feel for a language?
I feel like there's two kinds of programmers. There's programmers that will build a Lisp in a language for fun, and then programmers that won't. And you seem to very concretely fall into the group of people that will.
Which I think I'm a failed PhD student. So,
well, I think it's a fantastic place to be. Like, if you're in that camp, the camp that will just build a Lisp for fun, like you're probably never going to struggle with employment, I would imagine.
I hope so.
there's my prophecy. We can check back in 10 years or so. Cool. No, so this is really cool. Like I said, I've never written a book myself. Pretty much everything. Yeah. I've done in like the education space in Go has been like kind of more like articles. So it's like all text-based for the most part, maybe a few videos, but I've always had this advantage that like I publish an article or I publish a page on a website and I say something that I'd rather word a different way, or God forbid is actually incorrect and I need to go update it. I can just go update it really quickly. Like, I've never published something in print. Is that a stressful thing? Like, you go publish this big book, and then I imagine if it were me, afterwards I'd go back and read it and be like, I wish I would have like said this a little bit differently. Have you ever had any experiences like that?
Yeah, there was one thing actually. The example this is part of the reason why there is a second edition. As you're getting towards the end of the book, it's kind of like, I'm kind of done. I just want this book to be finished. And I had lots of great reviewers. One of them said, you know, this example in your concurrency chapter is kind of terrible. And I'm like, I'm not going to pay any attention to you. I'm going to write a publish in this book. And then I started doing some presentations based around the content in the book. And I was doing like presentations to different groups. And I said, I have a concurrency chapter. I'll do a presentation on concurrency. And I'm like, I got this great example at the end of the chapter. I'll use that for my talk. And I start using it. I'm like, oh my God, this example is awful. This is the worst. I can't explain this at all. And I'm like, Robert was right. But of course, at that point, book published is too late. Second edition fixes the example. So I threw it out for that slide deck. I threw out the example from the book, wrote a second one that did the exact same thing, only in a comprehensible way. And in the book, second edition of the book, that's the example that I used.
Examples are hard, man. I mean, that's one thing I have done a lot of, is just written tons and tons of examples, and it's not easy. And I feel like I do feel like you do this well. I did read through the book. I think a lot of people don't do examples well. I have a lot of pet peeves around examples. Things like very simple, like foo bar type implementations. That stuff works for me. The like, you know, x equals foo. When you're writing for more experienced developers that like really just want like, give me the raw syntax. But I work with a lot of newer developers and I sometimes really struggle to come up with, sometimes you have to get a little creative to like, okay, I'm trying to explain concurrency, but I'm also trying to explain it in such a way that someone who's never actually done concurrency before can understand why it's useful, because that sometimes is even the harder thing in my mind. Is there anything that you ran into when you were writing the book in particular that you had like pet peeves about in other people's writings that you wanted to improve on?
The example one is a little bit of it. I don't want to badmouth the book. there's like the Go programming language book, like the book that you know Brian Kernighan writes, and it uses these examples that are kind of weird. It was actually the book I used as a reference while I was working. I wanted to make sure I wasn't like copying somebody else's stuff inadvertently, but that one was just so good I would actually use that one to step back and check and make sure I wasn't just making stuff up.
Yeah.
But it had some examples in the book that were just like kind of like out there. But the target audience wasn't beginning developers, which is a very hard place to be when you're trying to do this. And it's hard right. when you're writing a book to target know who you're talking to in the first place. I was very intentionally trying to target more experienced developers who already knew a language or two, because otherwise there's things you would explain and things you just don't explain. I can kind of skip over and assume yeah. knowledge of. And that helps a lot, because it does, like you said, levels up your examples, levels up your language too.
Right. You can use simpler, well, I should say more concise words, right, to explain the same concept.
Yeah. You have a common understanding, a common vocabulary you can start from. The pointer chapter actually was the one where that was probably the hardest thing to solve, because a lot, maybe even most developers today really are unaware of pointers and probably a little bit afraid of it when they hear about it. And so I had to like spend a part of that chapter explaining, you've already been using pointers. Like, there's nothing scary about them. In fact, it's not having pointers sometimes is actually the thing that's unusual that's going on here. So it's trying to find a way to gently break people into the concepts. That was the yeah. hardest one, I think, to do.
The funny thing to me is like a lot of the scariest stuff when it comes to pointers and like references, if you widen the net a little bit, you run into in other languages. Like when I teach Python, right? Like you can just change lists and it will alter weird parts of your program that you weren't expecting it to. And when I tell people that Go has pointers, one of the things I very quickly say is, but no pointer arithmetic.
Right. Sort of. I do cover the last chapter of my book is the fun stuff. And it was the second last chapter in the first edition. It's now the last chapter in the second edition. It's all the dangerous things you can do in Go.
Oh, no.
And there is unsafe, which lets you do pointer arithmetic. but it's the chapter is called Here There Be Dragons.
That's scary. In fact, that was going to be one of my questions. I was reading through your book and I got to the section on the go-to keyword.
Yes.
And I'm like, I forgot Go has go-to in it. No one uses this thing.
Nope.
Why? Do you have it? Do you know why? Like, why do we have this thing in this language? It's a modern language. Dijkstra warned us about go-to statements like 50 years ago. What are we doing here?
So what Dijkstra warned us about is not what Go does. So Go's go-to is very well behaved. It's like the pointers where they sit there and kind of like made it tame. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with go-to is like you may skip in like C, for example, or other, or just doing a jump in assembly language, is you may skip over a variable initialization, you may skip out of context, and so it's kind of you've lost the thread, right? You can do the long jump out of things and have to come back. So what Go's go-to does, it says if you try to jump over a variable declaration, it says nope, compiler will catch it and say you can't do that. It's intended just basically it's basically intended for math operations where you have some complicated algorithm. And there's some common cleanup code that's going to happen at the very end. So I'm going to do some stuff. If this situation happens, bail early and jump to this common cleanup code. Otherwise, keep on processing and do the other stuff. Sometimes it's easier to do it this way. They have like a bunch of if-elses and Booleans. You don't have go-to in the language. You declare a Boolean variable and then declare that Boolean and break out of a bunch of things to a label and then put an if statement wrapping some code. It's actually worse if you didn't have go-to in those situations. But realistically speaking, you're not going to use it. It was kind of cool to show it in a language and show what a safe go-to would look like. But I've never run across someone using it for real in production.
Yeah, that example is interesting to me. Yeah, I don't think I've ever even seen it, let alone write it.
Yeah. I had to do a search through the standard library to find a couple examples just to like show it does exist.
Just to find it. Yeah, that makes sense. That example you gave is really interesting to me, though, because it sounds like something the defer keyword would maybe handle. Is that, am I missing something there?
I mean, defer is a little bit different. Defer is meant for different kind of cleanup. It's also function based. It's not block based. So oftentimes you don't want to have the defer works when it's when your function's bounded. You're like finished with the function. You're done. You want to clean up on exit a function. But
right.
Oftentimes this actually is a thing that catches people sometimes. They refactor their code. They'll have like a loop that's creating opening files or something. And they'll put a defer close, yeah. And they're not actually closing until you actually leave the function, which is not what they intended to do. You can do something bad and go like create like a closure right there in place and use that as a block and then you attach a defer to that. That's ugly. It's kind of not really what you should do. Just put the defer there and be done with it. You should just put the close there and be done with it, not try to use a defer in that situation.
That makes sense. I found myself wanting to put a defer in a loop quite a few times. But usually like the right answer is like, actually, let's make this thing its own function and then call that in a loop.
Right. That's kind of the nice thing. When you see like a code smell, like Go is push you in a direction of how it wants you to write your code. And if you find yourself fighting the language, this is true in every language. Like it's not just Go. It's every language that treats it this way. That when you find yourself fighting the language, you're probably doing the wrong thing. You're probably writing your code in a worse way. This would be harder for other people to read.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I've worked with, so this is actually funny. I didn't realize that you had, you know, so much experience in Java or that you had a Java background coming into Go. Most developers that I have worked with coming into Go from JavaScript or even Python tend to have a good time. And oftentimes the people I've worked with that are coming from Java tend to have a bad time, not because like they can't handle it. It's not that. Yeah. They just like don't like it, right? It's very different than where they're coming from in the Java world. So I'm a little curious what your perspective is just on that shift of just coming from Java to Go.
I think it's the love of magic. I left Java because I didn't like the magic, but I started like in C. I started in Pascal and C and assembly and, you know, old school stuff. So when I see, I like the idea. Go feels to me like a better C. I mean, the people who built it again were the people who built, a lot of them people who built C in the first place. So it's like they went back after 40, 50 years and said, what did we do wrong? What could we fix today? What are the things that have made C programming so painful? And they said, oh, these are the things. And that's a very different mindset than Java, where you're, with the objects and the virtual dispatch annotations. It's just a different style and philosophy of development. And I like what Java could do for me. And then I stopped liking what Java, like I said, got too complicated to do the things I want to do. And the fact that every version of Java is adding more and more functionality in every single release, you just can't know the whole language anymore. I think I was described as like lava flow development patterns. You can tell like what year some Java code was written based on the features they're using. And this year, the new style is going to be this functionality. So we have these features in our code. Oh, wait, this year, the new features are these features. So we're going to have this functionality in the code. It's like go back through like old code that you're maintaining and say, ah, that's the 2015 edition. I can tell.
That's the feel I get in, I've done a lot more JavaScript than I have Java. But it's a similar thing, right? Like when let and const came out, it was like immediately all the new JavaScript code uses these keywords to declare variables. Whereas, you know, you back up and it's var. That presents an interesting problem for like finding answers online, especially as a newer developer, right? You find yourself Googling for things and happening upon old Stack Overflows that like sometimes the code still works, but it's very often there's a much better way to do it. Like now, and at least to me, it seems like Go doesn't have at least that as much of a problem with that. It's been around for what, 12 years now, and it seems to just be a little. It moves slower.
It does. So I did a talk in 2020 called "Go is Boring and That's Fantastic," and it was all about how most of Go's features date from the 1970s, and the reason why they were chosen is because they kind of work, and everyone kind of knows that they are good. And I use the analogy, the book appears in my book really briefly too, that when you're building a bridge, like bridges are important things. We've been building them for like 5,000, 7,000 years, we've been building bridges. And we expect them just to work. Bridges are really boring, but it's kind of exciting if a bridge fails, that's huge news. Yeah. If a program works the first time, that's huge news. and that's a little scary, right? Like we don't get second chances at bridges. And we don't want people building bridge with exciting new things. We want boring, stable things that we're sure, you don't want to be the first guy to drive over that bridge. That someone said, this is a really cool idea. I think it's going to work. I've never tried it before, but trust me, right? That's not my bridge. I'll take a boat. So Go is intentionally like that. And there have been changes. The tooling around Go has changed a bunch over time, especially. That's been the big change. And I've got a couple of call outs in the book where I say, this is the old way of doing things. Don't do this anymore. You see things online telling you to build using a centralized directory for it. Don't do that. Use modules. But there have been changes recently. So generics was the first really big change that happened to the language. But it was designed to be backwards compatible, and it's mostly invisible. The standard library didn't actually add anything generic until, I think, the last release, to 121. And now 122 is actually introducing something pretty interesting, which is the first backwards breaking change. But it's an opt-in backwards breaking change also. So it's kind of fascinating.
I read about this. Can you elaborate? Do you have it?
Yeah, I was racing my book against this being announced. This is like, I delayed the book by a little bit to make sure this was actually going to happen. So I was covered in the book. For loops in Go, for loops in most languages, you reuse, you declare a variable, you have, you know, your I equals 0 to 10. That I gets declared once, and every time you go through the loop, you're copying the value into that same variable over and over again. So you create the variable exactly once. And that worked fine until you got to closures, and especially when you got to concurrency. So Go's concurrency model is built around launching closures into their own threads of execution called Go routines. Yeah. And if you were, because it's called a closure because it closes over the environment, which includes keeping a reference to those variables that have been used. So if you have a loop, which is a very common thing to do, I'm launching a bunch of Go routines to go do some work for me. I have an index variable and I pass that index, I use that index variable directly inside of each of those Go routines as they're being launched. And conceptually, you look at that and you say, oh, I'm going to pass a different value into each of those Go routines, but you're not. Because you passed a reference to the same variable into all the Go routines, and what they actually get is the last value assigned to it by the time the Go routines get a chance to run. And when this happens in production code, it's pretty bad, but you notice it relatively quickly. The really pernicious thing is it happens in test codes. So you run your tests in parallel, and you think you're testing a bunch of different values. You're not. You're just testing that last value in your test.
The largest value of I, typically, right?
Exactly right. And so the Go team realized they made a mistake in the language when they did this. And so they went through like every bit of code they could possibly find. And they could not find a single example where someone did this intentionally, like where they really wanted that behavior. Hmm. And so they talked to a bunch of people. Turns out that C# ran into this issue about 5-10 years ago. I'm not a C# developer. And they just said, forget it. We're just going to break the language. From now on, every time you iterate through a for loop, we're creating a brand new variable. And they took a little bit of pain and everyone loved it and went on. But Go had this mechanism with modules where they wanted to forward and backwards compatibility. And so in your Go mod file, you declare the version of Go you're using. And this is module by module. So you bring a third-party code that applies also. And so what they're doing starting in 122 is based on the value the value of Go assigned in your Go mod file, it decides what the behavior is going to be for a for loop. So if it's 122 or higher, you get the new behavior. We'll create a new variable each time. If it's 121 or earlier, you get the old behavior where it creates only one variable once. And so this way, your old code doesn't change. Your new code will change, but you won't be caught unintentionally doing it. So if you want to fix your code, bump the Go version in your mod file and you get the new behavior. But it's this really clever idea of how do I revise my language and fix big mistakes, but not break anybody? And yeah. C# didn't have that functionality available.
I love that. It sounds amazing in user space, like as a user of the Go programming language. It sounds like a pain in the ass as a maintainer. You have to build the Go tooling to actually deal with that, right?
You do. And they're actually trying to be very good about backwards compatibility. There's a variable called Go debug you can set when you launch your programs. And Go debug lets you actually control, they've promised backwards compatibility. Go's very good in this compatibility promise. But sometimes they have to tweak algorithms in ways that would still meet the compatibility promise, but they may have some unexpected behaviors. And oftentimes it means it broke Kubernetes is really what they care about, because Kubernetes is probably the biggest thing written in Go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there's now this Go debug flag that says, okay, here's the thing I changed, like TLS rules, for example. There's been a few other ones that have happened. And when we make these changes, we promise that this flag is going to still work for 2 years. I forget what the actual rule was. We may go back and revisit this. But if you set it, you'll get the old behavior still. If you don't set it, you get the new behavior. And this, again, to support this is kind of a pain for the Go team. They've got to actually have these multiple paths in the code base, but but they want to guarantee that backwards compatibility because it is software engineering, right? It is something that has to last for a long time, and you can't just break people. Like, this is something, right, I think that's hard for developers to understand sometimes. You can't just throw it out and break people. Their livelihoods depend on these things working. They need some trust.
Well, like, the farther you go down the stack, I don't know if stack's the right word, but the farther you go down in like layers of abstraction, the more and more stable things need to get, right? There's the famous like Linus Torvalds, like, we don't break user space, right? Like, whereas in my application code, I break user space all the time. But like, we make the trade-offs, right? Because we have to change where the button is 17 times a day when the product manager asks us to move it. Different world, I guess.
It's true, but there's a balance though, right? Like, there's some behaviors you can break and some behaviors you can't break for customers. Mm-hmm. Like, moving buttons around, the customers kind of accept it, although some grumble a little bit. Like, I could find it before, why can't I find it now? But other things, like if there's like data you're keeping track, like your database is forever, right? Like, anything that makes into the database, like, lives, a customer comes back to that. You can't say, yeah, I renamed your stuff, enjoy. They put that in, they want to get it back out again. Like, so that level of handling and those kind of things are frozen. And the code's ephemeral, like, data is forever.
Yes. Yeah, I wrote an article about this, in fact, where basically I was like, you really should like compute things for as long as you can, because the minute you start storing it, you kind of are making a promise either to yourselves or to some team somewhere, or maybe to a customer. It's a lot harder to make those changes later.
It is. And once dollars come into play, it's, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, are you at Datadog currently?
I am.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine this is like what you guys do all the time.
It is. These are things we have to think about, right? It's like the balance between how do you improve customer experience, make their lives better, but you can't break them. We are mission critical software for big companies. Like, we're not working correctly, some companies can't operate because they can't trust their environments. And that's this really awesome responsibility. You just have to think twice about what you're doing, be very careful with all the work you're doing, because you just can't.
Right. I can only imagine. Do you work on like a part of the, I know Datadog has a lot of like APIs and SDKs. Do you work on that like developer facing stuff, or are you on like internal systems?
I'm actually in a weird other place. So the team I'm on is the APM onboarding team. I work for APM's application performance management. The tracing tools are the primary thing that are part of our group, but there's profiling tools and other things, security tools. And one of my responsibility is how to make it as easy as possible for our customers to start adopting our tools. Like, it's tended to be really easy to adopt monitoring, to adopt logging and metrics, but APM is a little bit more of a hurdle because it involved some changes by developers to their applications.
Right.
And we wanted to make it as easy for operations people to be able to add tracing support and profiling support and so on without having to get a developer involved. And so I tell people I do magic tricks for a living. That's my job.
Are you trying to sidecar in, like you're trying to get applications deployed within applications without actually making code changes? That's kind of what I heard.
That's more or less what I spent the last year doing. So, and now it works. It's great. It's fantastic seeing it out there. We had a big announcement at our developer conference Dash in August. Uptake's been really exciting. It was spontaneous applause, which is kind of nice. Like, there was no like cue the applause when people announced it. It was like, oh, we want this feature. Great.
Yeah.
And those were existing customers. Like, the new customers is really where that's at. You want new customers to come in and have this magical experience when they first use your product. But keep it all safe and secure, not like break them.
Right.
It's it's a balance, like I said.
It's always the right number of hacks, right? Like, you're always trying to find the right number of hacks, which actually brings me back to a question that I had for you. So the title of the book is, let me pull up so I don't botch it, An Idiomatic Approach to, so Learning Go, An Idiomatic Approach to Real World Go Programming, right?
Yeah.
Speaking of hacks, can you explain what idiomatic means? This word is used all the time in programming. I feel like, some new developers might not know what it means.
Yeah, it's used as a weapon sometimes. Developers like to argue. So, I mean, the concept of the idiomatic is I'm making my code that meets two criteria. One, other people understand what I'm doing. And two, I'm not fighting the language. I'm working in the way the language intends. I'm kind of like, carving. I'm the Michelangelo quote, I'm discovering the statue within the block of marble. You're going with what's actually in there. And that's really what idiomatic is about. Like, what's the style that people tend to write their code in? And the style is chosen because it actually fits with the way the language was designed. These are the features and how they compose together. And like you mentioned, like Java developers come in and have a hard time because they want that inheritance. They want to impose this idea of inheritance and a lot of layers and a lot of misunderstanding how interfaces work. It's a very different model of interfaces. And it doesn't match the mental model. So when I first started learning Go, I said, oh, type embedding, inheritance, that's pretty much the same. I bet I can make it work. And I wrote this awful code trying to make it work, and it doesn't. And I think every Java developer or developer has experience with inheritance comes to Go and does this at least once, and then realizes, no, I'm fighting the language. It's not idiomatic for a reason.
Right. And then either give up or continue fighting tooth and nail. I've seen both.
Yes. And they get really angry at Go for this. It's like, you know, there's a Simpsons episode where Ned is complaining to the minister about something, and the minister says, Ned, have you ever thought about other religions are all pretty much the same? I often felt that way when people complain about Go. It's like, just try one of the other languages. They're all pretty much the same.
Just try something else. Please go away.
Yeah. It's okay. You don't have to like it. This is a way in a philosophy of developing software. If it's not yours, that's fine. That's okay. But if you're curious about it and think this might be a strategy you like, here's how to learn about it.
We like it. Please stop ruining it for us. What are some of the examples, some of like the most egregious examples of non-idiomatic code, like big foot guns?
Let's see. People, the big one is trying to fake inheritance. The people doing that just don't really get it. And they get really upset about this. People like writing getters and setters, treating structs like they're objects. Overuse of pointers, especially, is one of the things I see a lot. The Java, everything's an object except for a couple of primitives, and everything's being heap allocated. And this is actually hurting Java right now. Like, Java's garbage collectors are really smart because they have to be. And Java programs use a ton of memory and have those pauses because everything is heap allocated. Right. And Go encourage you to keep things stack allocated because cleaning up a stack is easy. Just slide a stack pointer down, everything's cleaned up and you're done. Cleaning up a heap is kind of painful, it's kind of slow, and it's unavoidable. Some things have to go in a heap, but it's worse. And so Go gives you tools to avoid doing that. And it makes your programs faster, makes them use less memory. There's like no downsides to it. It encourages a bit of immutability, which Go is not good at. And people fight it. Every struct, everything's a pointer, and they pass around pointers, they return back pointers. Pointers are faster. Like, no, they're actually slower because there's a heap allocation happening. And actually have numbers in the pointer chapter, like, show, here's a benchmark program. It has all the code and shows you what happens as you pass pointers back and forth. You're actually making your program worse by doing this.
I want to pause on this. This is actually really interesting. I don't think yet on the podcast we've dug into stack versus heap. So I'd like to just cover it for a second. So really quickly, sure. Can you explain high level, what's the difference between stack and heap in memory?
Oh boy, this is going back in time to explain this.
Very
sure.
High
so,
level. You can wave your hands as much as you want.
Yeah. Okay. So it's basically programs need memory to do things, and they've got to put them somewhere. And so as a program is running, you have a function, it's running, it's trying to store a value somewhere to have a variable to store a value. And the question is, how long is that value going to be valid for? Is the value going to stop being valid when I exit the function, or does it need to live for longer? And if the value goes away when you leave the function, then you can allocate what's called the stack, which is a straight, it's like just going counting down from memory. Traditionally, stacks counted down, they can count up, it doesn't really make a difference, but it's this linear growth of memory. So I just allocate one after another after another. And then when I'm done with the function, I pop it from my stack, and as a stack pointer, you just go back to the previous function. Everything that you allocated there, just gone. Very quick, very simple way to clean up. Now, if a value is going to live after you've left that function, returning something back out, you've got two choices. You can make a copy of that value back to the other function, in which case you can get rid of your value and just copy it back to the previous function, possibly on its stack. Or you put it up in memory, and what you have to pass back instead is a pointer to it. And this is what all pointers are. Pointers is references to stuff on a heap. And so you pass back a pointer instead and copy that instead, and the memory that the value actually has lives in what's called the heap. And the heap is just a bunch of memory, different sizes of blocks being allocated, and it lives until all the references to it are gone. And that's, if you have a garbage collected language, its job is to keep track of all those pointers that you have going back to your stack. And when there's no pointers left on the stack, you can deallocate, you can garbage collect it. That's all garbage is memory you're not using anymore. If you're in C, then you got to keep track of that yourself. And if you're in Rust, you have to play garbage collector, and they tell you, nah, the program won't compile until you break it up everything correct. And so C has no garbage collector. In Rust, you are the garbage collector. In Java and Go, there is a garbage collector in the runtime.
Got it. So, okay. So just, I'm going to play it back just to make sure I understood everything. So yeah. Stack is kind of, they're both memory, right? Like these both live yes. in RAM. Stack is like simple and fast to use. Heap is like yes. longer lived, maybe a little less efficient to get in and out of, but you can maybe use more of it, or you use it for a longer period of time.
So traditionally, one of the limitations on stack allocation in languages like C and Java is that the stack size is bounded. So I think it's like 64 megs maybe by default. Go is weird. Go lets you grow the stack. And so, which is ironic because so when you call a function in Go, it actually the first thing it does in that function is check to see if there's enough room in the stack. And if not, it will grow it and copy everything over there. The irony is that things on the stack are relocatable. They can move in memory. Things on the heap in Go never move. So once you allocate some memory on the heap, it lives there until it's done. But things on the stack get moved around all the time.
Okay. And if I'm hearing you correctly, generally speaking, when we use pointers, we're going to the heap. When we don't, generally speaking, we're going to the stack. And correct. A lot of people, and I've definitely I hear this all the time, will say, well, pointers are fast because if I use a pointer, I don't have to like copy the memory, right? I'm just passing around a reference to it. And that's why it's fast. But what you're saying is, in a lot of cases, it's faster to not use a pointer because I'm able to stay on the stack rather than move to the heap.
It's returning the value back from the function in particular where using a pointer starts biting you because it's not just like there's two things going on. There's an allocation, like the memory is still being created. It's just being allocated on the heap instead. And then you copy back the 8-byte pointer usually 8-byte pointer now because it's 64-bit machines. So the idea with the pointer is that I'm only copying 8 bytes each time, so it's smaller. Right. Well, first of all, if your value is smaller than 8 bytes, there's no difference. right. And if your value isn't smaller than 8 bytes, well, sure, it takes a nanosecond or two to make the copy, but I ran the numbers in the book. Like, we're talking not many nanoseconds. That's probably not the optimization that actually matters. And especially in a language like Go, where Go doesn't let you declare something as constant, when you put something on the stack and you pass it from function to function, it's making a copy of that value. And it's effectively immutable now. So if I pass a parameter into a function and it's a value, not a reference type value, but a value, and I modify inside that function, that modification is not visible outside that function because it was a copy of it. The original never got modified. Where if I pass a pointer in, it's like the behavior described in Python before, I can modify it and all sorts of crazy things can happen. Right. And who knows what changed it where, right? Yeah. And now you got to sit there and walk through all your code to try to find where things happened. So be careful what you wish for. Like, oh, maybe save me a nanosecond of time on my program running and it cost me an hour tracking down bugs. Yeah. Is that a great trade-off? Probably not.
Well, it's also just weird. Like, I read your function, and I'm like, oh, you're giving back a pointer to a string. Like, I wonder why, right? Like, am I supposed to do something with this string now? Whereas if you just gave me a string, I'd probably just, you know, take it for what it is. The advice I usually give, and I'm actually curious to hear what you think about this, see if maybe my advice could be improved, is, like, don't use pointers unless you have a reason to. And that reason is very rarely performance. And if it is performance, you should be pretty sure because you've benchmarked it. Like you've figured out exactly what the hop path is and you found that using a pointer actually would help. But until then, you kind of only use pointers when you really do need that mutable reference to something.
Yeah, absolutely. That is more or less the advice I give out all the time. The only difference, yeah, good, keep it up. the only thing is there's a pattern again in Go. This is I have mixed feelings about it, which is if you have a struct or you have some type and you've got methods on this type, and one method requires you to have a pointer type on it, has a reference type, just make all of your methods pointer types at that point.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I've seen that advice. Well. It's pretty common. It's because of typesets on interfaces and having it meet it. I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about it because it does send kind of the wrong message sometime. But
well, it can get tough because you can have potentially lots of methods on a type, and it can get kind of weird when you have to only use pointers. But
yeah,
I know what you mean. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about some of your favorite tools in the Go space. So you've obviously been doing Go for a while. Do you have any favorite I mean, obviously, I'm sure you use like the Go standard library and the standard tool chain. Are there any other tools that you use day to day? Things like linters, formatters, debuggers, anything like that that you think people should be aware of?
Yeah. So let's see. So IDE wise, I think I use Golang. I use IntelliJ. I've been using IntelliJ for literally 21 years. Bought my first license in 2002.
You came from Java. You have to use IntelliJ.
I do. And when they announced the Go version, I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. My fingers have never left it. I use Visual Studio Code because, of course, you have to by law, I think, at some point use Visual Studio Code. But
punishments
most of the time, I'm in IntelliJ.
Yeah.
And so, yes, big recommend. Definitely use that for your IDE. It does everything you need to do. It's Go supports excellence. Everything else supports excellence. For formatting, I'm fine with GoFump most of the time. I think GoImports is the one that will fix your import order also. Mm-hmm. That's fine. Sometimes it gets annoying because I've had linters fail because it has my imports are in the wrong order. I'm like, really? This is not important. There's one linter we have at work that does that. Every so often I forget to run something and it complains. There's Golang CI Lint, I think is what it's called. I forget the name wrong.
I love that one.
That one is great for having like a billion tools available. If there's something you want to validate with your code, it's there. Go Vet's actually gotten very good. There's a new tool that's been released called Go Vuln Check, which does CVE checks against your code. And so rather than relying on some third party to scan your code, you just run Go Vuln Check against your applications. It'll tell you if it's vulnerable based on some known CVEs. And it's clever enough to say, oh, some function in this module is known to be vulnerable, but you're not using it. So it's not as big of a deal for you to worry about. You're using this one, that's vulnerable. You should worry about that.
Oh, that's nice.
There's actually a chapter on Go tooling I added in the second edition because I realized that the tools are a big part of what makes Go great. And I totally ignored that in the first book. So in the second edition, I added a whole chapter on all the different tools that are available. Go embed, which is kind of not quite a tool, but it's like a feature.
Yeah.
It's weirdly handy. This idea of like, you can just like take text files and binaries and embed them into your Go binary and use them, because one of the nice things with your Go programs is you go back to having that single binary. Like in Java, like class files are all loose, you know, jar files, and you have multiple jar files, and then people get Uber jar files out of their jar file because having that single file is so important. But you still have a JVM hanging around, right? Or Python and Ruby, and you still have the JVM, you still have a virtual machine hanging around. But Go gives you that one file that you can email it to somebody. Like, it doesn't matter how you distribute it. Like, the single file is great. So if you have like support files that are immutable, like you have like a little bit of HTML or something, a simple UI or some help files, just be able to put them in the binary and not worry about, are they actually being copied along with my stuff? Is someone going to modify it behind my back? No, it's part of the binary.
I've loved Go Embed.
Yes.
Like I ever since it was released, I've started using it a ton because it's exactly what you just said. Like the idea of dynamic linking or dynamic dependencies, right, in like C, for example, I feel like sometimes file-based dependencies just feel the exact same way, in the sense that like, if this file doesn't exist, I can't run my program. Like it doesn't fail in the same way, but it's still kind of a failure. So being able to it's that idea of static compiling, dynamic compiling. Yeah, thank you. Static linking. That's what I was looking for. Being able to bundle the files directly into the binary has been amazing. I did run into one really weird thing that I now have to tell you about with Go Embed. I went and started a little discussion about it on the Golang repo. With Go Embed, you can't really embed Go files. So you can embed basically any type of file out there, like markdown files, like whatever. Yeah. But if there's a go.mod in a directory, it will ignore it. And there's great reasons for that. But it's really frustrating when you're trying to build a website that bundles in like full Go, like directories of Go code to use as like examples on the website. You can't actually bundle in Go code. So that was a weird thing I ran into.
That's fascinating. I never even thought about that. Huh.
Yeah, because it ignores it, because it assumes that, like, you know, all of your Go files in your project are going to be compiled into the end binary, right?
Sure.
And so, yeah, there's, like, this special case made, basically, to, like, ignore... I can't remember if it was ignore anything with a go.mod or ignore things with the .go extension. There's some... And I tried to, like, hack my way around it. It's actually really hard to hack your way around as well. But yeah, that was a tricky thing for us.
See, now you're giving me something I want to fix in my book, and it's too late. This is not good.
I'm sure, like, very few people run into this. I have a very weird use case where, like, on Boot Dev, we have students that are, like, running Go code in their browser in WebAssembly, and I'm trying to, like, ship Go files to them. It's, like, a really meta thing that, like, most companies aren't going to run into, but it was interesting.
Nice.
Cool. What is your least favorite thing about Go? What would you change about the language?
Go needs a better immutability story. Like, this is the fact that constant Go just means something the compiler can figure out is not great. Like I said, that using the pointer type versus value type to indicate immutability is okay, but it falls apart in some cases. Like with slices being passed around, it's kind of weird. Because I have a big chunk explained, like, with slice behavior as you pass it around. And I did a talk at GopherCon called Go Says What. It was based on the what talk about Ruby and JavaScript. And when it was a game show, I was running, like, here's four things, here's some code, here's four things it could be doing. What's it doing? And this is why it did that weird thing. And slices were like 10% of that talk. Yeah. It's just like, here's weird things slices do because you pass them around. Because, yeah, it's a pointer and you copied a pointer so you can change the values. But you didn't really want to change those values. If you grow it, you can't get them back again. It's like, yes. Once you understand the mental model of what a slice is, it's all fine. Explaining it to a new developer is impossible. Like, I've tried. Their eyes just glaze over. Like, but why did that happen? Why is this different? It's like, well, you see, when you look at the implementation and the runtime, they're like, oh my God. Yeah. It's awful. And the reason why it's awful is because there's no way to just declare a slice as const. There's no way to declare a map as const, especially. Like, maps are always mutable. There's no way to declare this, you know. So you run into these situations where I just want to pass it this long. I want the compiler to tell me if someone's tried to modify my thing. And you can't really do that in Go terribly well in some situations. And especially with concurrency, it's a miss because there's a race detector that checks to see if cross-Go routines, you've modified the same value in two places. If I could just, like, declare it const, then it wouldn't be a problem. Right. But I can't. So there's a possibility that this value has been captured and been modified in two places.
It is pretty ironic. Like, Go has a really strong concurrency story, but it's also a very well-known, like, fact in computer science that immutability makes concurrency a lot easier.
Yes.
And we don't have a strong...
I don't understand why it is the way it is. I'm sure that, you know, they're smarter than me. Like, these are really smart people. Yeah. They made a decision. They probably had a really good reason for it, but I kind of wish they had a different answer.
Yeah. No, I definitely get that. I'm the same way. I like the idea of compile time constants. I just feel like they ate up a really useful keyword, const,
yes.
Right? Like, maybe it could have been, I don't know, maybe it could have been something else. I surely couldn't design the language. Like you said, I'm not pretending to be able to do a better job, but I know what you mean. If you were trying to sell sell Go to a Python developer specifically, what's the benefit of the language that you'd focus on explaining?
Oh, types. I'm a type snob, I guess, in languages. I mean, I was, when Ruby was a big thing, like 2004, 2006, 2008, I did some Ruby on Rails development, and these Ruby's developers are like, oh, I don't need types in my code. I'll write unit tests. And I'm like, really? No one, that's not true. We all know that's a lie. No one writes unit tests. No one's going to check their stuff.
You're not actually going to write that well.
We all say we're doing it, but none of us are doing it the right way. I mean, Go to me strikes this nice balance. Like, people hear types, oh, I've got to declare, it's like, they think sort of thinking like Scala or like some, or Haskell or some other language like that. It's like, types are executable documentation, right? I put this note in my code that says, this thing is this, and my buddy, the compiler, is going to check it for me. I don't have to do anything. If I make a mistake, it will catch it for me. My IDE will draw a little red squiggle under it if I mess it up. I can autocomplete it better. I know exactly what I'm getting, right? In Python code, I pass a something into a function, and I don't know what that something is. And one thing I tell people is there is always a type, right? All data has a type. It just whether or not it's explicit or implicit in your code. So when you look at that Python function, someone passed it into you, or I call a Python function. I know they have type hints now, but type hints aren't really enforced, and there's lots of code that doesn't use them. And it's like, okay, what did you pass me? What are you looking for? I don't even know what you actually want until I read your source code. And you're going to call something else that's going to take that value and pass it to something else. I'm going to read that source code to figure it out. And maybe it'll all kind of work in the end. And maybe it won't. And People must be much smarter than me to like keep all this running in their head and keep their program logic in their head, because I can't do it. So that's, I think, the big win is there's relatively simple language, there's relatively low maintenance and low noise, but you get types.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And I guess that's, you could basically make the argument that that's probably what you would say for any dynamically typed language, right?
It kind of is. I'm, you know, God bless these people. I don't know how they do it.
I was talking to a Ruby developer recently. I think his episode comes out next week, which will have been like, I don't know, 4 weeks ago by the time this episode comes out. But he basically said he loves programming in Ruby for like web apps, but he also never wants to fly on a plane that has Ruby aboard.
So that reminds me of the warning in Java, the Java license. You used to say you can't like run nuclear reactors with Java code.
Yeah. Same basic idea.
Yeah.
Cool. This has been fantastic, John. Could you tell everybody where they can go find your stuff, and obviously specifically where they can find your book?
Oh, sure. So I have a bunch of blog posts actually up on Medium. Look for John Bodner on Medium. It's probably me. The book, I have a course I did years ago for Pact Publishing called Learn Go in 3 Hours. It's mostly still okay. The section on dependencies could use some love, but you know. Yeah. And the book is from O'Reilly, Learn and Go. The first edition is available. Second edition is coming out in just a few months. So as much as I want people to buy as many copies of my book as they possibly can, I don't want you to be disappointed when you find out a new edition's coming. Pre-release is already up on O'Reilly's website. There's the first, most of the chapters are available. They've all been written at this point. The book's been done for a little bit. I'm now in copy editing. So if you have O'Reilly Learning Access, used to be called Safari, you can access the book there. Amazon, every bookstore you can think of will have copies of the book as well.
That's amazing.
Yeah, give it a chance. Take a look.
No, thank you so much. Like I said, I love the book. I've got a lot of students on Boot Dev that I don't know how familiar you are with Boot Dev. Obviously, Josh Hales is a kind of mutual acquaintance of ours through Boot Dev, at least on my end. But we do a lot of online interactive learning, and I get asked all the time, like, where's a book I could go pick up to like read on the side while I'm doing this? And Learn and Go is definitely going to be my recommendation. John.
The next edition's including exercises as well, with answers up on GitHub, so you can work through the exercises and see if you've got the right answer and why it's right or wrong. So
perfect. Great.
It's good for your students.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on, John.
Thanks so much, Lane.